Yeah, so I'm not a comedian, so so this is joint work with Steve and some work with a graduate student, Alice Niels, who's now working for Apple Computer, and Andrew Landahl, who is at Sandia. So the best thing about this talk, first of all, is exactly the fact that Steve is working with me on this. So that's great, because rarely do you get an opportunity to roast somebody, right, who's your collaborator. So this is a great picture at Wolf Creek. Yeah. So this is Steve jumping off of some ridiculous cliff. But what's great about this is he clearly, what is he doing? He's reaching back and like, did he forget to strap in? Oops, I forgot to strap myself in. Or, yeah. So first of all, now that's a big problem, right? Snowboarders with this one ski thing. But then there's also, he's like, maybe he's pointing at something, right? So, what is it? Like a jackalope over there? Look at that point. He's like, it's like Babe Ruth calling his things. But we all know, because he's a quantum information theorist, what he's really thinking as he's jumping off this cliff is, I'll bet most states are too entangled to be used as computational resources, which is why he crashed when he landed. So, okay. So let's go back to 1946. This is a picture of the ENIAC, or an IAC. I never know how to say it. And I always like to show this to my students, because I like to, when I had to teach Introduction to Digital Design, I like to point out this 5 million hand-soldered joints, right, which just seems like an amazing amount of pain. So this thing had somewhere around almost 18,000 vacuum tubes. It actually had a fairly amazing amount of computational power. That is, when it actually worked. It turns out that this thing had a failure of something around one vacuum tube failure per day. So if you sort of scale up everything, that actually corresponds to something like one transistor failing in your computer every second today. Okay. And I always sort of imagine, when this happened, when that one vacuum tube failed, right, what happened was, they didn't have Windows, right? So what happened? Well, the equivalent was the blue screen of death, but it was a blue light bulb that they turned on, right? So, and I can say that coming from Seattle, right? So, okay, so this is the ENIAC, and of course, why I'm putting this up here is, this is a failure rate. It's a computer that doesn't work. So we can imagine an alternative history of the world. So imagine that there's no transistors. Imagine there's no integrated circuits. Imagine you're John Lennon, whatever, right? So no servers. These things are ancient now. We rarely even have these, right? No iPhones. No internet-enabled surfboards. This is the cool thing about being a computer science department, is you could write a grant to build an internet-enabled surfboard, right? So, no, that's real. That's in San Diego. That's a real Intel-sponsored. So, of course, so this is the classic question of von Neumann. Can you build a computer out of unreliable components? Or the classic problem that was, in theory, solved by John von Neumann in this paper, Probabilistic Logics and the Synthesis of Reliable, it's probably organisms from unreliable components, 1956. There's some interesting citations if you look at this paper. This paper actually references John von Neumann. I mean, sorry, not Marie Guillemin. And it turns out that von Neumann stopped off on the way to driving to Los Alamos from Princeton and saw Murray. And that's how he got in the acknowledgement section. It's kind of a weird bit of history. So, of course, what von Neumann did, or not of course, but you may know this history, von Neumann was able to show that if you had a model in which you have a circuit with G gates, and each of these can be made to fail with some probability epsilon, then if that probability is below some threshold, which he estimated, then you can make this circuit more robust. Okay? So you can replace that circuit with G gates by one that's of size G log G over epsilon, and you can make it fail with this probability P, right? So, sorry, did I have the epsilons wrong here? Failing with probability epsilon, right, assuming your probability of failure per gate is below this threshold. But of course, there's another, the reason I put this up there, so this is the reason we're interested in quantum computing, is we have our own threshold theorem like this. But of course, in the real world, we don't know this, right? So we don't need this, right? So, in the real world, we don't use the constructions, at least not in our current computers, to actually make reliable computation, because we have hard drives, which are pretty reliable, and our integrated circuits, which are fairly reliable as well, though as we shrink to smaller scales, that's starting to become an issue. And so you can ask the question for quantum computing, is this, is it possible to do something like this as opposed to something like this, right? So this was sort of the motivation that Kataev took in thinking about topological quantum computing. So Kataev said the following. He said, magnetism arise. It's probably actually what he said. That's probably not right. Magnetism arise from spins of individual atoms. Each spin is quite sensitive to thermal fluctuations, but the spins interact with each other and tend to be oriented in the same direction. The sun spin slips the opposite direction. The interaction forces it to flip back the other direction. This process is quite similar to standard error correction procedure. We may say that errors are being corrected at the physical level. And then he says, can we propose something similar in the quantum case? And he says, yes, but it's not so simple, which is a great, if you've ever read that paper, it's a great statement because, you know, the first part of the paper is fairly simple, but then all of a sudden, you know, hot algebras appear out of nowhere, right? So when he said it's not so simple, you kind of run for the door. But this was Kataev's sort of motivation was, can we build physical fault tolerance into the system? And the idea that he came up with was this idea of topological quantum computing. And in sort of an abstract manner, what this was is that you could use these particles that occur in a physical many-body system, which have exotic statistics. They have statistics corresponding to non-abelian anions. And so you could take these particles, braid them around each other, and do quantum computations. So the picture is something like this. You have a two-dimensional system which supports these exotic particles. You create them in pairs, and then you braid them around each other, and then you annihilate them back together, and that corresponds to some sort of measurement at the end of the computation. And this has been the motivation for the entire field of topological quantum computation. And there's a huge history of this with Kataev, and particularly the work from Microsoft, Michael Friedman. And many of you probably know this story, but it's sort of an alternative way to compute. So what I'm interested in this model is this feels kind of cool. You know, you do this computation, you braid these things, and there are statements made throughout the literature on this subject about this being sort of tolerant to errors. And sometimes this is well motivated, and sometimes it's not. And what I'm interested in sort of pushing is how well motivated is it? What do they really mean by that? What's the exact limits of this topological protection? Okay, and I'm going to show you a simple example towards the end of this of how that robustness, you know, how you can sort of rigorously get at that from a more quantum computing perspective than from a sort of physics argument, which sometimes involves a little bit of this hand waving. So, in particular, I'll skip this for a second. In particular, let's do this. Okay, so this is the simplest model you can think about. This is Kataev's torque code. You have a system of qubits we can put it on periodic boundary conditions. We put our qubits on the edges, and so we're in this torus. And then we have the following operators, which are going to be our stabilizer operators for our code. They're the plaquette operators, so associated with each plaquette, we associate an operator with four Zs acting on the edges surrounding that plaquette. And I'll often call those plaques, and I'm sorry. I hope there aren't any dentists in the audience, but plaquettes. And then there are vertex operators, and the vertex operator is associated with each vertex, and it operates on the four surrounding qubits on the edges, and it's now it's the four Xs in this case going around there, which is like 3X, but not a beer. So what Kataev's system is, this is a code that's stabilized by, is it four, what is it, Nostro? Oh, is it four Xs? Okay, sorry, I forgot. Maybe that beer had something to do with it. So there's an Australian beer called 4X, apparently. So we should call this the Australian bear code. So Kataev said, okay, each of these operators, this is a stabilizer code. We can define the code space as the plus one eigenspace of all of these commuting operators. And he constructed a Hamiltonian. Okay, and this is the toric code Hamiltonian, and it'll be sort of my cartoon picture for fault tolerance. It doesn't give you anything universal, but it gives you a good idea about sort of some of the structure that a lot of the topological quantum computing systems have that I want to talk about. Okay, so here's a little bit of controversy, or it's more controversial when I talk to topological quantum computing people. And the question that I want to ask is topological quantum computing fault tolerant in this sense of a theorem like von Neumann? Okay, so is it true that it gives you the same sort of guarantees? And I would argue that the answer is no. So I would say that people who say that it's fault tolerant in the same way that the threshold theorem gives you fault tolerance, that's not correct. Okay. But I also think that this is maybe the wrong definition. So there's something subtle going on here that I think is actually important, that perhaps this version of the threshold theorem, in some sense, is maybe a little bit over the top. And I'll explain what I mean by that. Now, there are issues with what I'm going to say, but let me just jump in and then people can object. Does anybody object here? No? Okay, so here's a cartoon guide to physical fault tolerance. So let's do the classical world, okay, because this gives you some things to compare and talk about in sort of reference to fault tolerance. So this is, you know, the simplest model of a memory that you could think of, right? It's an icing model in one or two dimensions. So here I've done it in two dimensions. You have this energy, which is gives you a minus J if the spins are, which are now plus or minus one, are aligned. And if they're anti-aligned, it gives you plus J energy. And this is a toy model for a hard drive, right? You have these spins. If most of them pointed up, you say that's zero. And if most of them pointed down, you say that's one. Okay, so there's a magnetization order parameter here, which, you know, if it's greater than some number or less than some number, you say that's zero or one. And that's the way you digitize your information, which you always need to do at some point. Okay, so this is a model for a system that can store information. But of course, we need to talk about how do we store information in this. This is just some system that has an energy associated with every configuration of the spins. So let's stick some dynamics on there, and let's stick the simplest noise model we can think of, right? That does something like a realistic model would do if it was, you know, if each of these spins was now connected to some thermal environment. You can just come up with a very simple one, and the basic idea is just to do Metropolis Monte Carlo, right? So pick a spin at random. If flipping the spin would decrease the energy, then flip it. And if flipping a spin would increase the energy, then flip it with a Boltzmann, with a probability proportional to this Boltzmann factor, right? So minus 1 over the temperature times the change in energy. This is just Metropolis Monte Carlo. And this is, in some ways, a reasonable cartoon guide to how a thermal environment would interact. So probably a better model would be to use, you know, a heat bath operation here. But this gives you sort of the same idea. You have some local operation that's sort of going in, and if it decreases the energy, then you do it. And if it increases it, then you do it with some probability proportional to this Boltzmann temperature. OK, so now let's suppose we're trying to store information in this system. And we make a distinction between the one-dimensional icing model and the two-dimensional icing model. So in the one-dimensional model, if you start out, so you point all your spins up and all your spins down, then what happens? Well, if you look at the long-term behavior of this thing, you know, the only place that this thing sort of maintains its information, so when t is equal to 0, right, then you can never flip any of the spins, right? So if you store your information in there, it just gets stuck. But if you turn up the temperature and you wait long enough, then this thing will thermalize. And at non-zero temperature, the magnetization goes to 0. And you only have these sort of two stable points at temperature 0. So in some sense, if you try to store information in the equilibrium state of the system, you're kind of doomed. Okay? But of course, there's also something going on here, which is it takes time for the system to relax back to its equilibrium, right? And so if you look at the rate at which that occurs, well, it actually occurs related to this. There's some cost to flip the spins, right? And then this 1 over temperature here. So the ratio of that energy gap to the temperature. And if this is sufficiently cold, if the temperature is much, much less than the gap, then this can be actually made fairly long. Now, you can contrast this with the two-dimensional version. Now, what happens in the two-dimensional version? Well, now you have sort of an interesting phase diagram at non-zero temperature. Below some critical temperature, there are these two states which are actually, technically, they're using this Metropolis update, they're probably metastable in that in some really long time scale, proportional to the size of the system, you actually will thermalize between these two states. So in other words, your hard drive does of it, well, there's stray magnetic fields, but you know, so there's some really long time behavior of this. But if you look for anything that's reasonable, considering it's going to be a lifetime which is proportional to the size of the system, then you have these two equilibrium states. So you can think about storing information in there, letting the system come to equilibrium, and you know, the information just basically never decays away. Well, above that critical temperature, it's just like the one-dimensional icing model. And right near the critical temperature, there's some weird scaling behavior. Yeah?
You said something about it being metastable on a time scale the size of the system. Did you mean exponential?
Exponential in the size of the system. Yeah. The lifetime. Yeah. The lifetime is proportional to the size of the system. Right.
No, you're right. You're right. Exponential in the size of the system. That's what I meant to say.
Yes.
And it turns out that, so for the IC model, with even this update, I think in two dimensions, if you freeze the boundary conditions, it's not known how to prove that statement. It's an open issue that computer scientists have worked on.
Majority of your spins flip all at once, right?
That's basically what you're waiting for. So hell freezing over. Yeah. Okay, so but this is just for memory.
Right, and I think there's an important distinction to be made between memory and fault tolerance. Now, fault tolerance is, you know, we want to do some gates on this information. Now, this is, you know, just a memory of a bit. So what's the silliest thing you can do? Well, you can flip a bit, right? So what happens in the one-dimensional model, no matter where you are at what temperature, right? You start decaying, your information starts decaying away as a function of time. You flip the bits. You can't do that perfectly. So it goes down, you know, this is 0.6 something, and this is minus 0.5. You don't flip them perfectly. Right, and so you get even worse, and each gate you do successively adds in its error, and you know not only do you have this slow decay going on, but you're also aiding that decay by messing up your operations of not being able to flip every spin perfectly. Okay, what happens in the two-dimensional model below the critical temperature? So if you do it below the critical temperature, you know, you start up mostly one, you flip it, you don't quite do things perfectly, but now you have this nice property that the system likes to relax back to the equilibrium state. So it will correct the errors that you made in flipping those spins. Okay, so this is what I would call a self-correcting system, in that it corrects these errors that you're making while you're trying to do the operations on the information. Okay, so in some sense, that means one-dimensional is good for memory if you're at extremely low temperature, below that energy gap. But in doing computations, you have to have something that's like the two-dimensional model. Okay, so here's the Kataev model. I'm going to take that as my straw man to talk about these things. You could ask the question, is the Kataev model, which has this, so it has a system, which has a ground state, and then it has an energy gap. So to create excitations, it requires some energy. You could store quantum information in it. The ground state is on a torus, is fourfold degenerate. You can store information in there. So is it like the one-dimensional model, or is it like the two-dimensional model? Well, it's like the one-dimensional model. Okay, so a good reference for sort of pinning this down is actually this paper by Alitsky et al. And the information decays exactly because the excitations that you create here are particle-like. They violate sort of, you can create excitations which only violate two of these conditions. So you have these particle-like excitations, which is like the one-dimensional model, and you get this basically the exact result that you'd expect for the one-dimensional model. Now, there's a four-dimensional version of the Torek code in which that's not true, okay? And then you get this dependent on the size, right? So e to the minus c times the number of spins, okay? And that's in this other paper, which is Alitsky and Triple Horodecki, okay? So this, I would argue, means that, great, here, we know that if we create the temperature, if we create the gap, right, is big, and we're we have a temperature well below that gap, this might be like the one-dimensional model. So in some sense, you know, if you do just the naivest algorithm for factoring a number, this is a large number that's a product of two primes, if you can get your temperature low enough, you can play this game. Let's play a game where we just try to crank the temperature down. Now, this is hard in, say, the fractional quantum Hall systems that people are talking about. The temperature you're actually talking about is not it's the actual temperature of the electron gas, and it's hard to get that cool, right? And so there's a lot of issues with getting that, but if you can play that game of just making things cold, right, it seems reasonable to think about extending the lifetime by some fairly large factor, right, which will allow you to do something like a quantum algorithm to factor a large number. Okay, so it seems like that for storing information, everything's fine. The question is, what about doing operations on that information? So there, the one-dimensional model was not really fault-tolerant because every time you did an operation, you created an error and those errors added. Okay. So this is the basic question that I think is one of the most interesting questions for me for thinking about how to do computation on fault-tolerantly on topological quantum systems. And so, you know, in doing this, you can start looking through the literature and say, well, what have people have said about this? So here's from the review article, RevModFizz. It's mostly about the fractured quantum Hall system, so there's some other stuff in there as well. But you can ask, how do they talk about the gates, right? Why do they think they can do those fault-tolerantly? We know that they think they can store for a long time because they're at a low temperature. Okay, that's explicitly in here. But what about, what's the criteria that you're using to actually talk about the fault tolerance of the gates? So it says, we now introduce into the systems Hamiltonian, a scalar potential composed of many local traps, which they even put in quotations, each sufficient to capture exactly one quasi-particle. These traps may be created by impurities, by small gates, or by the potential created by tips of scanning microscopes. So whenever there's like a lot of things that they could be, right, like may be created by, I'm a little skeptical, right? So the quasi-particle charge means the potential introduced by the trap and quasi-particle tip combination cannot be observed by local measurements far away. And then they talk about how you would actually then move these around. Okay. And so what I would like to do is to say, well, this is, you know, in some ways a good description of how this might work, but we want to be able to actually calculate this robustness in some way, right? Well, the previous thing we knew that we could talk about the rate proportional to this e to the minus, you know, this Boltzmann factor. What's the equivalent statement here for this, right? What's this equivalent statement for being fault tolerant for doing the operations? Yeah.
So dummy question here. I understand what they're proposing. I just don't understand what the point of it. What's this supposed to accomplish?
So this is the way. So they want to be able to create
these anions in the system. So you have your fractional quantum Hall system. You want to be able to create these excitations and then, say, braid them around each other. And then actually you want to be able to observe them as well by bringing them together and observe what they fuse into. So they're trying to get the computation part of the thing, of the computation down.
So this is not anything about
This is how you interact with the system, and it's supposed to give you the fault tolerance in the sense that when they talk about this, they'll say that you move these things, you move the traps around adiabatically. So they say, you know, so there's some appeal to being adiabatic in the entire evolution, right? But, you know, this is sort of the, and in the fractional quantum Hall, it would be, you know, trying to create a field, a local scalar field that somehow gets one particle or many particles in. So the problem is that in all of these systems, it's extremely hard to actually rigorously analyze everything because, for instance, they don't even know if the wave function that they have for the ground state is correct, right?
Why would I think of this as being a fault-tolerant way of implementing gates? What's fault-tolerant about this?
So the fact that the charges are somehow, that these charges that these particles carry is somehow not measurable locally.
That's one thing that's going on here. The other thing that, so this part doesn't talk about the adiabatic moving it, but the fact that you can adiabatically somehow move these things around is also implicitly assumed in there.
And on the topological motion that you make.
So that's right. So there's also this
path, the wrong path, so long as it's topologically correct, you get the same gate.
That's right.
Okay. So this, basically I'm getting a discrete set of gates out of this, and therefore it is robust to small errors in potential.
Well, that therefore doesn't follow from what you said,
so there's sort of
discrete statements.
So there's the braiding operation has this topological nature, which makes it so that doing that, getting the correct topology, including the creation and annihilation, if that topology is correct, then you've done a gate that's independent of having wiggled those lines in any weird way.
Okay.
That's one robustness. The other robustness is, well, how could you possibly actually do those things like create the particles and move them? And I'm more interested in that second part, which is the part that is harder to analyze.
Okay,
so this is the problem. How does one do this? This is exactly what I want to bring up. So every operation needs to be done with exceptionally small error, right, in order to call this fault tolerant. And so let's just take the simplest model, tie it to code, and try to figure this out. So this is where I started thinking a little bit about this. And there's a broader context, which is within self-correcting systems in quantum computation. So there are four-dimensional topological torque code. How do you do computations on them? But more generally, when I started talking with Steve about this, you just asked the following question. What is this? Well, they're somehow suggesting that they have states that are somehow have a topological nature, meaning that you need non-local operations that span some, you know, large amount of the system in order to get at the information in the system. So they have quantum error correcting code states, right?
And what they're doing is they're somehow suggesting that by adiabatically changing a Hamiltonian who has eigenstates, which are quantum error-correcting code space, they can start here and end up over here and have done something non-trivial on the code. Right? They've done some gate. And in particular, their gate depends only on the topology of what they've chosen. So we just said, well, OK, let's do this with quantum error correcting codes. And Hamiltonians that have quantum error correcting codes as their degenerate eigenspaces, and you really would like to require that it remains degenerate throughout the entire evolution. That is, you don't want this thing to split halfway through the quantum. So this thing is a qubit, an encoded qubit. You don't really want that energy to split halfway through, because then you'll get a Barry's phase that depends on, you know, the actual timing that you use in this adiabatic evolution. Right? Okay, so this is an example. If you don't return to the same Hamiltonian you started with, this is an example of open loop holonomic evolution, because you have this degenerate ground space. So we worked on that. We tried different codes. And then we thought, well, let's do the silliest code we know. So here's the silliest code I know. It's involved in teleportation. Apologies to those who don't think about it as a code, but this is the way I always think about it. So what is the teleportation? Well, you start out with your unknown qubit here, unknown qubit in an unknown state, however you want to think about it. You have your Bell pair between these other two qubits. You make a measurement on those first two qubits, conditional on that outcome. Right? You can perform an operation on the third qubit, and the information is transmitted psi to psi prime. So we can think about that as a code. The code is, initially, we have all the information in the first qubit. And then the second qubit is in this particular state. Yeah.
Phi plus, those would be the two classical bits, if you measured them?
Over here. Yeah, this is a particular outcome. That's right. So the point is that you could do the measurement and apply an operation which brought you back to So at the beginning of the operation, you end up start with this code, right, where you have a singlet between the 2 and 3 and your quantum information here. And at the end of the day, you do a measurement in the Bell basis over here on these two. So you end up with one of the states.
One of the four Bell states.
One of the four Bell states, right? And then, you have this state which is possibly changed. Okay, so we said, well, what if you just try to drag between this and this, where we post-selected sort of one of the outcomes? Okay, so here's a way to do that. The initial stabilizer for this is just the ZZ on the last two and the XX on the last two. The same for the stabilizer, the final stabilizer, which now you have the ZZ on the first one and the XX on the second one. These are the two codes that we're trying to drag between. Okay? And so you can construct the Hamiltonian in the normal way we often do from stabilizers, which is to make a negative sum of the stabilizer elements such that the plus one eigenstate is now the ground state energy of this. So in other words, we start out with what people call the XY interaction, but I've used Z here, but it doesn't matter. So you start out with XX plus ZZ on the last two qubits, and then on the first two qubits, you're going to end up with XX ZZ, and you're going to adiabatically drag yourself from here to here. So you could do a linear interpolation. It turns out that's not the best thing to do to get your error rate smallest. To get your error rate smaller, you actually want this thing to be a little bit smoother, but it doesn't really make that much of a difference. And you ask, well, what happens? You know, here we have a degenerate two-level system, and at the end we have a two-level degenerate system. Does there, you know, first of all, do we remain degenerate throughout? And if so, what happens to the information? So to analyze that, all you need to do is think about a new set of encodings. So instead of using those stabilizer operators, think about the following set of logical operators. So we have three encoded qubits here. The X1 is, you know, the X on the first and second qubit, and then the Z1 is the Z on the second and third qubit. Those anti-commute with each other. The X2 is the opposite. You flip the role of X and Z. And then there's this third qubit, this third encoded qubit, which is three X's and three Z's. Okay? So if you think about that encoded qubit, so those poly operators, then your initial Hamiltonian is just a sum of a Z1 on the first encoded qubit, a Z on the first encoded qubit, and an X on the second encoded qubit, because that's the Z2, Z3, right? It's acting on the second and third, and then X2 is on, the X is on the second and third as well. Right? Okay, and your final one, similarly, has just reversed the role of X and Z. Notice the third qubit's not involved at all. Right? So therefore, by definition, information encoded into the third qubit
will be untouched, right? And this also means there's a twofold degeneracy for all of your states. Okay, so you adiabatically drag it, and then what are you doing? Well, you're just changing adiabatically from a qubit, which has a energy, a term which is a poly pointing along z to a poly and pointing along, along x. So all you do is you go from the plus one eigenstate of this encoded z to the plus one eigenstate of this encoded x when you adiabatically drag it. The gap shrinks by a little bit, right? But it's just, if this original gap is 2, then this becomes square root.
You are interacting, no? Systems 2 and 3?
Yeah. So it's not teleportation at all. It's because it's just this motivation of so why is this teleportation at all? Well, because it's, what is teleportation? It's swapping, but in this, teleportation is the actual protocol where you're, where you're explicitly doing this communication. But that analogy basically is going to carry over. What's going to happen? And now this is what I'll show next, right? So what I've said here is that you're just changing this, between these, you're starting in the plus one eigenvalues of these encoded things, and nothing happens in the third cube, in this third encoded qubit. But what happens to that information initially in the first qubit? Well, it ends up going to exactly to this third qubit. And the way to see that is just to note that you can write the unencoded, the bare poly operators, x1 and z1, in terms of these encoded poly operators times that third qubit. And in particular, we start out in the plus one eigenspace of this and start out in the plus one eigenspace of this. So in other words, at the very beginning, it really is true that the information that's in that third encoded qubit really is in the first unencoded qubit. And because we end up in the plus one eigenstate of these two here, the same is true at the end. The information in the physically in the third is actually the same as the information in that encoded qubit. So if you adiabatically sweep between, you have your three qubits, you adiabatically turn off this singlet on the interactions between 2 and 3 and turn on the ones in 1 and 2, you will teleport, quote, quote, your qubit across. You'll adiabatically swap. Okay, so why is this neat? Well, why I think this is neat is there's a lot of reasons, because it starts to inspire you to think about other ways of doing adiabatic manipulations in topological systems. But it also just gives you a kind of neat architecture for building a quantum computer. Because you can now do things like apply gates, right? So in the same analogy that we can do gate teleportation, right? In gate teleportation, we change our initial state that we have when we're doing the teleportation. Here we change our initial Hamiltonian, right? Rotate the third qubit by some unitary. And when you do this evolution adiabatically to one where you don't have anything rotated on your final Hamiltonian, but now it's on qubits 1 and 2, you will have swapped and applied the unitary U3. So for example, if your initial Hamiltonian is xz plus zx, and you swap to xxzz on the first two qubits, you will have applied the Hadamard operation to your information. Okay, so this allows you now to build a computer, right? So one qubit gates you can do by this, sort of evolution that I talked about, where you do this unitary on your initial Hamiltonian. Two qubit gates, how do you do them? Well, you just take two of these lines, so these are your two qubits coming in here, and now you apply a two qubit gate to that Hamiltonian, the initial Hamiltonian. The final Hamiltonian stays the same as the sum of these two local Hamiltonians, and you will have, when you do this evolution, you have applied the two-qubit gate to those two-qubit states. Now, of course, there's a little bit of a problem in terms of, not a little bit, but there's a problem here in terms of physicality, right? If we do this, if we conjugate XXZZ, say, by a controlled phase or by a controlled knot, this will now have three-qubit interactions. So one of the things that you can do is you can say, well, can we make it two-qubit interactions? So here's an example. So for example, if you do a controlled Z, this thing that had original two-qubit operations becomes three-qubit interactions, right? So you have like this XXZ and the ZXX, right? So you have these three-qubit interactions around. That's not as good. So how do you get around that? Well, a lot of us know this story now. It's, we do perturbation theory gadgets. So you can use a gadget in particular. In our paper, we talk about the one from Bartlett and Rudolph. And so you now apply... there's a couple subtleties that go on here. One is that you need to, this is a strong interaction between the 6A and 6B and 3A and 3B. And then you do an interaction that's perturbative, the red line between there. And you have to keep that one on. So what happens here is now you apply a 2-qubit gate and you've teleported into an encoded subspace. So you're at the very end of the day, your information will be over here, and using this just simple error detecting code, right, you will have done the gate on that information over that subspace. If you want to now continue on non-encoded information, well, you can run the thing backwards, right, without applying a gate, and you will then end up back with things that are not encoded. So the encoding is just an extra thing that you need in order to make this sort of as efficient as you can, because these gadgets have a nice property in that the strength of it. So there's an new energy gap here, which is not just that sort of dependent on that original delta, but is related to this lambda squared, the perturbative energy divided by this other stronger omega. So it becomes a weaker interaction in a physical implementation. But that's a very nice property of these gadgets. Okay, so this is the explicit construction. The minimum gap, like I said, is lambda squared over omega. You can actually look at there are two problems that happen. One is, not just that you actually have this new gap. The other problem that occurs is that your ground state's not the same, right? You really are requiring that you have the right ground state in order for this whole analogy to go through. And so there's an initial ground state fidelity, which also is, actually scales really nicely. Okay, so by making lambda over omega much, much smaller than 1, you can effectively do this using just 2-qubit interactions. So there are all sorts of variations on a theme you can do here. One is you can do exchange interactions, the full isotropic exchange interaction instead of these X plus ZZ anisotropic ones. You don't have to necessarily, what I've done is I've assumed that you have this operation or a rotated one available. But you could say, what if I want to just actually go from this one to one in which I've unitarily rotated one of the qubits? So this is sort of offline preparation of adiabatic gates. And you can show that with the proper choice of these unitaries, you can keep the gap. So it's not always true that you can do this. There are examples of Hamiltonians where you can't do this, where you can't offline do it. But using some this choice of actual unitary, you can do that offline thing. So these are small variations. Yeah.
If you want to apply the Hadamard gate, why don't you just turn on, look at Hamiltonian smoothly if you want, and then turn it off?
Yeah, turn on it. So, okay, so the first thing is that this is going to have, so this thing has, in some sense, a holonomic property, right? So if I'm just turning on the laser and I apply my Hadamard, I have all sorts of timing issues. Right here, what I'm doing is I'm adiabatically dragging between one Hamiltonian and the other, right? And now there are terms that you could possibly get that cause errors. But it's independent of the actual, you slowly turn this one on, slowly turn it off. It doesn't depend on that actual path that you're taking on those two control parameters, right? So it's a holonomic implementation. Now, it's interesting because most holonomic things actually do gates where you go in a cycle, right? Here, we never do that. Well, not you can, but we never do that in this very basic model. So it's open loop holonomic evolution. Yeah?
Take the number of keys.
Okay, so now if you're going to build, let me do the architecture scheme. So if you try to do an entire quantum computer with this, right? So you try to do that. The important thing is that the gap for any one of these individual things ever, is only ever the square root of 2 times the original gap. So it doesn't have any dependence on the system size, right? And you're going to do this piecewise, right, throughout the entire computation. And so since it's piecewise, you just always stay with this constant gap, right? So there's another thing you could ask. So you were asking, how is this different, right? So you could also ask, well, why can't you just do something like this where you have, a qubit on one qubit, information on one qubit, and then you want to somehow end up with the information at the end of the day on the other qubit. And you can do this, but you can't do this in a holonomic way or a way that has, if you have this nice, say, linear or smooth interpolation between these two. With 2 qubits, it's impossible to actually do that sort of swapping without doing some complicated thing that depends on the path in some crazy way. So if you just do this linear interpretation, you can argue there's I won't go through this because it's not too much of a detail, but you can basically argue that any such way that you would adiabatically be swapping with 2 qubits will end up not being able to work as long as you're doing this interpolation between an initial and a final Hamiltonian like we were doing.
Okay, so then there's the architecture. So you could think of all sorts of ways to do this. One is, this is sort of the, so this is a single qubit computation. I sort of like this one because it shows the minimal number of Hamiltonians you need. So what happens, you know, you have what's going to happen here is you have three Hamiltonians, okay, and you're going to cycle between them. So you're going to turn on initially H1, then you're going to turn off H1, turn on H2, turn off H2, turn on H3, and then cycle, turn off H3, turn on H1, right? So you're going to cycle through that Hamiltonians. Each time you do that, what happens? Well, the information gets moved over and a gate is applied to it, depending on what rotation you did on that third qubit, right? And then in the next step, it's going to be what rotation you did on H2 on that fifth qubit. Similarly, down here, we have U3, right? When it does that thing, it's going to actually be applying U3, right? And so you can see that by cycling just between three Hamiltonians, you can build a universal quantum computer. So you just, you know, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and you'll be doing some circuit. This is one qubit. It works for two qubits as well. You just add another dimension. So that's kind of a minimal resources there. There's another cute one, which I call the rocking horse one, which is just take those three qubits and go back and forth applying gates, right? So you just move it forward, move it back, move it forward, move it back, move it forward. Even. And depending on whether you use encoded or not encoded qubit, this sort of uses the minimal number of qubits, you know, sort of assuming that you can't. You know, the other way to do it is just only use this at once during your computation. Okay, so this has a lot of precedence, and I'll get to the topological point. But this is basically an open-loop holonomic quantum computation. You know, in some ways it's nice. It gives you universal quantum computation, but unlike the adiabatic universal quantum computing where you start at one Hamiltonian and end at one Hamiltonian and that's it, here we're doing things piecewise, so we get a lot of extra power from doing that. Right? So it has sort of this path robustness, right, which is that you're turning on these interactions between these, you know, two qubits and then these other two qubits. So the degree to which you can independently turn those knobs, right, is what's giving you this sort of holonomic evolution. Now, in previous implementations of holonomic evolution, what you really do oftentimes is you say that there's some path, there's some independence. You know, if you stay adiabatic in this thing, you've done this computation, right? But you can't deviate that path. So maybe the area of the loop in space is the important thing. So it's robust to fluctuations that don't modify the area, right? But in those, the question is, in the physical implementation, why should you suggest that turning this is not independent from this? So if I'm doing it with one physical atom, say, I have a bunch of energy levels and I'm doing a holonomic computation, it's very difficult to argue why I should be able to control one sort of direction along this thing versus the other. Whereas here we really are only turning on interactions between two subsystems, which feels like at least a better control problem. Okay, so so there's details in there. So let's get back in the final minutes here to topological quantum computing. So what does this suggest? Well, this suggests that one way to start thinking about topological quantum computing is, you know, let's boost up to the next highest code after the teleportation type code and start talking about teleportation on Kataev's torque. Okay, so to do that, instead of using the model where you have, so there's sort of two models that people talk about for topological quantum computing. One is for the physical sort of setup. One is where you have this Hamiltonian and then the anions are actually excited energy levels, right? So they allude to this in that other paragraph where they said or, right? So one point of view is you have the Hamiltonian, it's always on, shine a laser, it creates these excitations, and then you can apply other operations, so other lasers, right, and move these things around. There's another view which says that really you can talk about the qubit as coming, arising from puncturing these codes. So here's a surface code, and I can create sort of these punctures where I have encoded information. Okay, and that's the model that I'm going to use here. So in particular, for say a smooth qubit, This qubit, the encoded qubit, has two types of has logical operators, which are things like Z operations, which go around the puncture, and X operations, which connect the smooth edge to another smooth edge. Okay, so this is the view that this is the sort of encoding scheme that I'm going to talk about. So when I talk about removing the puncture, this is a code deformation. Right, so it's a new code, meaning that I've removed this stabilizer, this stabilizer, this stabilizer, this stabilizer, and that one. Okay, so I've pulled that out, and when I do that, I have a new code. Right. Okay, so the question is, how do you do something like prepare a smooth, how do you prepare a smooth puncture? Well, the way to do this is you take your original Hamiltonian that's on, so you're in the ground state, you have this torque code Hamiltonian. If you're on a lattice like the one I've drawn here, there's no degeneracy in that ground state. And then what you do is you turn on an X operation between these two plaquettes, P1 and P2, while turning off these two plaquette operators. Okay. So when you do this, what's interesting is the following. We can think about that in terms of codes, right? So we can think about that as, you know, we have the plaquette operator here and the plaquette operator here. Why don't we promote those to encoded Z operations for some qubits, call it Z1 and Z2. And we now promote them to Z operations. So now we can define the encoded X operations. So one of those you could choose as the path that starts at a smooth edge and ends up here. And then you could choose another one that goes along the same path. So for the second qubit, you have an encoded operation which starts at the smooth edge, goes up the same path, and then overlaps here, right, on this qubit that's in the middle. In particular, that operation that I'm turning on, XA, is exactly X1 times X2, right? So in other words, in terms of a code, I can think about this as starting in, you know, Z1, Z2, the sum of those. Everything else in this entire Hamiltonian commutes with these things, right? So we don't need to worry about those. And while I'm turning this off, I'm going to turn on this encoded X1, X2. Now, what happens? Okay, well, what happens when you do that is, right, we're going from Z1, Z2 to X1, X2 encoded. Notice that Z1, Z2, that operator, the product of those two, commutes with everything. Right. What is Z1, Z2? Well, it's the product of those two plaquette operators. So it's a loop of Z's that goes around those two plaquettes. Right? And originally, we're in the plus one eigenstate of Z1, Z2, because we're in the plus one eigenstate of all the plaquette operators. So we're in the plus one eigenstate of this, and it commutes with this. So we stay in that plus one eigenstate. Right? So we stay in that. And then when within that subspace, this just looks like a one-qubit rotation because it looks like it's going from some encoded Z on that subspace to some encoded X. Okay, so it's the same sort of evolution. You'll end up in the plus one eigenstate space of this, but also in the plus one eigenstate of this because you stayed there. That's where you started, right? So there's a symmetry going on here that you're exploiting, right, which is that you're starting in this Z1, Z2, plus one eigenspace. You stay there. You end up in the plus one eigenstate of this X1, X2 operator. But that just means that your qubit's now pointing, you know, down along the X direction for that encoded operation. Okay, so in other words, this is the creation of a smooth qubit encoded into the plus one eigenstate of, so you've removed P1 and P2. They're the vertex operators, which you can also remove by turning off the component of the vertex operator on that qubit while keeping that other one on. It turns out you have energy level crossings up there because they commute, but you don't care about that because you're always in the ground state. And when you do that, at the end of the day, you'll end up in the plus one eigenvalue of the encoded Z for this smooth defect, this smooth puncture in your code. Okay, so I'll finish up here. So how do you do, what else can you do with this? Well, now you can grow them. How do you grow them? Now you turn on other magnetic fields, right? So you turn on, say, one here while turning off this plaquette operator, and you can grow this puncture. You can grow the puncture. You can also shrink it. You can't shrink it all the way down sort of to nothing, but you can shrink it, and you can move it, okay? So being able to do this allows you to do things like take the smooth puncture. You can do all the equivalent things for the rough puncture. Prepare them into plus one eigenvalues, and then braid them around each other. And you can do basically the sort of adiabatic thing that people talk about with topological quantum computation, but you can exactly analyze it because we're talking about this in stabilizer codes. Okay, now this toolkit, though, of plus one eigenvalue of Z and plus one eigenvalue of X is not universal. In fact, everything in this for list here commutes with each other, and that's not a surprise because these are abelian anions. Okay, so this doesn't give you universality. If you want to actually try to create this to universality, there's an obstacle, which is that you have to do something like, so for example, if you wanted to take this and make a universal quantum computer, you might want to be able to do measurements of the X and Z qubits, right? But how do you do that in such a way that you maintain the fault tolerance? So you have the Hamiltonian on, and you want to make a measurement. I maintain that whenever you do something like that in this model, you will possibly create excitations or have faults which are not guaranteed by the adiabaticity of this evolution. You'd also have to create magic states, which has similar problems, and that would require distillation. So you can do that. You can build up this entire model into a universal kit, toolkit, but it doesn't actually give you something universal. So let me skip that. Okay, so then the important question now is, well, can we push this further, right? And this is the subject of current research, pushing this into the next direction, which is more complicated models. But the important, so there's sort of two lessons here, right? Which is, the first lesson is that I think from thinking about topological quantum computing, you get this idea of deforming between Hamiltonians who have different, you know, whose energy eigenstates are error correcting codes, and using that to perform gates, okay? I think that's a very useful primitive that will apply much broader than just topological quantum computing. I also think the nice thing about this is that you can take this and now start actually asking, you know, what is that adiabaticity requirement? We all sort of know what we think the answer is going to be. It's related to the gap, right? But in particular, issues like measurement and, you know, preparation of these states can be addressed within these models in a sort of nice, rigorous way. And the hope is that you can push that all the way through to give you some idea of what they mean by that fault tolerance. That is proclaimed in most of the topological quantum. And with that, I will conclude and thank you for your time. Yes, sir.
Forget universal computation for the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really stick with the abelian anions, you're very limited. But Robert Rosendorf and his collaborators have this method which uses the Torque code and gets you like controlled NOT gates.
Yeah.
Which I think in your case would require taking one of these holes and splitting it into two holes.
Mm-hmm. So
with like creating like entangled pair on these two holes. Do you think you can do that?
So I don't know of a way to do that adiabatically. So anything that creates the entanglement small and then stretches it out in that initial creation, you end up with a problem.
Right.
So it turns out your controlled knot right here is always just from, it's only conditional on, you know, it's always from controlled from smooth. You have to define it with what basis, right? It's controlled with smooth and conditioned on the rough, right? So you never have that reverse controlled knot, which is what you need to boost this up to get you.
No. What you need for what he's doing is to create EPR pairs.
Yeah. So that would be eigenstates of ZZ and XX, right? The encoded
right.
ZZ and XX. And because the code, when you do create a defect and try to stretch it out or something, right? When you try to do that pinching thing, you're going to break the symmetry in some way.
Right.
And it's that pinching that actually is, you know, if you do it by a measurement, then you can get a EPR pair, but then why is that tolerant, right? So maybe it's true that actually, I guess there is a question about whether that resource by itself can give you universality in a distillation type.
You might be able to herald it or something, or like, you know, try to pinch and try to herald on the result of something.
So I'm just saying that you can't, in this setting, separate codes?
So you can't separate them, right? That's, you can try it. You can turn that field off in between them, right? And when you do that,
there is no problem, right?
So, as far as I know, there is a problem. You try to pinch it off, and so you can pinch off whole sections of the code, right? But if I take this thing and I have a string going between it and I have to turn that final one off, there's a degeneracy that is going to disappear when I do that.
But are you going to put them together or separating them?
I'm talking about separating them.
So separating will increase the inertia.
Separating them should increase the degeneracy.
So it's an initialization, and it's well defined because of global properties and so on.
The problem is though when you do that, you have eigenstates which are coming down, which you're not guaranteed by any topological symmetry can't be affected, right? So if you do this, I think with systems that are not like the abelian ones, then you have this property, you know, sort of that preparation step have that property.
We can discuss this.
Yeah, okay. Other questions?
I have a so suppose we apply this adiabatic gate rotation to rhetorical. I'm wondering if we call this process as a unit of the some simple computation process, right? You said it's not universal, but still we can implement some say rotation or some zero, right?
Yeah.
And is computational time proportional to the system size?
So you mean what is the actual power of this computational model?
No, I mean I'm asking so because the because now the, you have basically the quantum memory, right, in some sense.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether this is the unit of this computation process is longer. Basically, it's nicer in some sense because you have the better protection, but because of this leap Robertson type argument, it seems that in order to somehow modify the information in the code space, you may.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe you're asking about the, so my motivation was to talk about the actual robustness, right? And that's now guaranteed in this case by the 80-bat condition. So you can get a bound based on that. So you have to go slower. I mean, it turns out that if you go with a speed that's like 1/1 the gap.
And I guess the gap is constant?
Yeah, so the gap's constant. Right now, you could also do things like turn on a magnetic field across an entire region. And when you do that, the gap actually scales like 1/1 the size of the region. So doing things piecewise is actually very useful.
But then I don't understand if we can somehow, because basically information is still encoded on the ground subspace, right?
Yeah.
And the basically locally changing some of the type Hamiltonian, we are somehow changing what we implementing some operation on the ground subspace, right?
Yes.
And why can you implement this operation in constant time?
I think what he's asking is, right, we have gate times which are now controlled by a gap since we're doing our gates adiabatically.
Yeah.
Right, but the lifetime of the information is also controlled by the gap.
That's right.
So how are we going to do gates, right? Or, you know, how does the relative scaling work? Is that right?
Yeah, so you distinguish gate operation time and the coherent time? Yeah,
well, no, I'm saying is that the question
so
that you're asking?
So one is dependent on how the decoherence will act, which is this you know, gap over the temperature, e to the minus, right? So it's that scale. The other one is related by how slowly you change you do this deformation.
Yes, I'm asking this time as a gate operation time.
Yeah, so there's still an error associated with this, right? And, you know, it does act each time you do it. So, and the question is, you know, it sounds bad because it's adiabatic, but it's still, you know, you still always want it, you want to do this on a size which is proportional to the, so that time scale is, you know, that e to the minus beta j, that was with respect to the bare decoherence across something that has an energy gap of j. So I'm measuring things in sort of that energy. So you can do a lot of gates, you know, if with the memory, you still have this added to bare. Right, from the added adiabatic condition being violated, because you can't ever do anything perfectly. Okay.
So, there's something I don't understand. Are you still using the topological order in order to protect from errors, for instance, in Hamiltonian? In other words, do you still want your system to be big?
Yes. Well, so.
Because if these punctures are big, then to move them one around the other, it takes a time. A larger time, right?
Yeah, it takes a time proportional to that size that you have. So so you're asking, why not just do everything in a small version of this?
I don't know.
I mean, I think that, so for this model, because you don't get universality, I think in some sense, this model is not rich enough to actually give you the real reason you want to do topological quantum computing. So I think that's what's going on. Because there are protected versions, you know, this fact that you do have these large logical operators is the part that's giving you the topological protection. And the only way in which that ever comes into play in this model really is, you know, that you actually get encoded into this thing and then grow it, right? So you can get into that code space, but that's the only place it ever appears, right? You're preparing the plus one Z. It's also important to note that when you're preparing the plus one encoded Z, as you grow this defect, right, then you the operation which actually affects that information is always topological. It's the distance to the edge. So you can start in the middle of this thing, grow it, and if the operation which will flip that information in some way is you're protected against that. And that, so that's really the only topological protection.
Any more questions?
So if not, that's fine.
Okay.